Hello and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a feature article by Shaw et al. Early changes in arterial partial pressure of carbon dioxide and blood pressure after starting extracorporeal membrane oxygenation in children. Extracorporeal Life Support Organization Database Study of Neurologic Complications. Objective: neurologic complications in pediatric patients supported by extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, are common and lead to morbidity and mortality. However, few modifiable factors are known. Design: retrospective study of the Extracorporeal Life Support Organization Registry from 2010 to 2019. Setting: multicenter international database. Patients: pediatric patients receiving ECMO from 2010 to 2019 for all indications and any mode of support. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We investigated if early relative change in partial pressure of carbon dioxide, or PaCO2, or mean arterial blood pressure, or MAP, soon after starting ECMO was associated with neurologic complications. The primary outcome of neurologic complications was defined as a report of seizures, central nervous system infarction or hemorrhage, or brain death. All-cause mortality, including brain death, was used as a secondary outcome. Out of 7,270 patients, 15.6% had neurologic complications. Neurologic complications increased when the relative PaCO2 decreased by greater than 50%, which occurred in 18.4% of patients, or 30 to 50%, which occurred in 16.5% of patients, versus those who'd had a minimal change, which was 13.9% of patients, with the p-values of less than 0.01 and p equal to 0.046. When the relative MAP increased greater than 50%, the rate of neurologic complications was 16.9% versus 13.1% in those with minimal change, with the p-value equal to 0.007. In a multivariable model adjusting for confounders, a relative decrease in PaCO2 greater than 30% was independently associated with greater odds of neurologic complication, with an odds ratio of 1.25, a 95% confidence interval of 1.07 to 1.46, and a p-value equal to 0.005. Within this group, a relative decrease in PaCO2 greater than 30%, the effects of increased relative MAP increased neurologic complications, 0.05% per blood pressure percentile, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.001 to 0.11 and a p-value equal to 0.05. Conclusions: in pediatric patients, a large decrease in PaCO2 and increase in MAP following ECMO initiation are both associated with neurologic complications. Future research focusing on managing these issues carefully soon after ECMO deployment can potentially help to reduce neurologic complications. Abstract 2 is a feature article by Perry et al. Unplanned extubation during pediatric cardiac intensive care, U.S. Multicenter Registry Study of Prevalence and Outcomes. Objectives: the epidemiology of unplanned extubations and associated adverse outcomes in pediatric cardiac intensive care units, or CICU. Design: registry data from August 2014 to October 2020. Setting: 45 pediatric cardiac critical care consortium hospitals. Patients: patients receiving mechanical ventilation via endotracheal tube, or ETT. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: 56,508 mechanical ventilation courses occurred in 36,696 patients, with a crude unplanned extubation rate of 2.8%. In cardiac surgical patients, unplanned extubation was associated with longer duration of mechanical ventilation, but we failed to find such association in medical patients. In both cohorts, unplanned extubation was associated with younger age, being underweight, and airway anomaly. In multivariable logistic regression, airway anomaly was associated with unplanned extubation in all patients. Younger age, higher Society of Thoracic Surgeons European Association for Cardiothoracic Surgery score category, longer duration of mechanical ventilation, and initial oral rather than nasal endotracheal tube are associated with unplanned extubation in the surgical group, but we failed to find such association in the medical group. unplanned extubation was associated with a higher re-intubation rate compared with the elective extubation, 26.8 versus 4.8%, with an odds ratio of 7.35, a 95% confidence interval of 6.44 to 8.39, and a p-value less than 0.0001 within 1 day of the event. After excluding patients having redirection of care, unplanned extubation was associated with at least threefold greater odds for each of ventilator-associated pneumonia, cardiac arrest, and use of mechanical circulatory support. However, we failed to identify an association between unplanned extubation and greater odds of mortality, 1.2 versus 0.8%, odds ratio of 1.48, 95% confidence interval of 0.86 to 2.54, p-value equal to 0.15, but uncertainty remains. Conclusions. Unplanned extubation in cardiac intensive care unit patients is associated with greater odds of cardiac arrest, ventilator-associated pneumonia, and mechanical circulatory support. Cardiac medical and surgical patients in the cardiac intensive care unit appear to have different explanatory factors associated with unplanned extubation, and perhaps these may be modifiable and tested in future collaborative population research. Abstract 3 is a feature article by Ishak et al. Biomarker-based risk stratification in pediatric sepsis from a low-middle-income country. Objectives. Most biomarker studies of sepsis originate from high-income countries, whereas mortality risk is higher in low- and middle-income countries. The second version of the Pediatric Sepsis Biomarker Risk Model, or PERSEVERE-2, has been validated in multiple North American PICUs for prognosis. Given differences in epidemiology, we assessed the performance of PERSEVERE-2 in septic children from Pakistan, a low-middle-income country. Due to uncertainty regarding how well PERSEVERE-2 would perform, we also assessed the utility of other select biomarkers reflecting endotheliopathy, coagulopathy, and lung injury. Design, prospective cohort study. Setting, PICU in Aga Khan University Hospital in Karachi, Pakistan. Patients, children less than 18 years old meeting pediatric modifications of adult sepsis 3 criteria between November 2020 and February 2022 were eligible. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Plasma was collected within 24 hours of admission and biomarkers quantified. The area under the receiver operating characteristic curve for PERSEVERE-2 to discriminate 28-day mortality was determined. Additional biomarkers were compared between survivors and non-survivors and between subjects with and without acute respiratory distress syndrome. In 86 subjects, including 20 non-survivors, or 23%, PERSEVERE-2 discriminated mortality. Area under the receiver operating characteristic curve was 0.83, with a 95% confidence interval of 0.72 to 0.94, and stratified the cohort into low, medium, and high risk of mortality. Biomarkers reflecting endotheliopathy, including angiopoietin 2 and intracellular adhesion molecule 1, increased across worsening risk strata. Angiopoietin 2, soluble thrombomodulin, and plasminogen activator inhibitor 1 were higher in non-survivors, and soluble receptor for advanced glycation end products and surfactant protein D were higher in children meeting acute respiratory distress syndrome criteria. Conclusions. PERSEVERE-2 performs well in septic children from Aga Khan University Hospital, representing the first validation of PERSEVERE-2 in a low-middle-income country. Patients possessed a biomarker profile comparable to that of sepsis from high-income countries, suggesting that biomarker-based enrichment strategies may be effective in this setting. Abstract 4 is a clinical investigation by Hamill et al., including the Pediatric Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome Incidence and Epidemiology Investigators and the Pediatric Acute Lung Injury and Sepsis Investigators, or PALISI, network. Association of interventions with outcomes in children at risk for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, a pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome incidence and epidemiology study. Objectives. Describe the frequency with which transfusion and medications that modulate lung injury are administered to children meeting at risk for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome criteria and evaluate for associations of transfusion, fluid balance, nutrition, and medications with unfavorable clinical outcomes. Design. Secondary analysis of the Pediatric Acute Respiratory Distress Syndrome Incidence and Epidemiology Study, a prospective point prevalence study. All enrolled at risk for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome patients were included unless they developed subsequent pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome within 24 hours of PICU admission or PICU length of stay was less than 24 hours. Univariate and multivariable analyses were used to identify associations between therapies given during the first 2 calendar days after at-risk for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome diagnosis and subsequent pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome diagnosis, which was the primary outcome, 28-day PICU-free days, and 28-day ventilator-free days. Setting: 37 international PICUs. Patients: 267 children meeting pediatric acute lung injury consensus conference at risk for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome criteria. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. During the first 2 days after meeting at risk for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome criteria, 55% of subjects received beta agonists, 42% received corticosteroids, 28% received diuretics, and 9% were transfused. Subsequent pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, which occurred in 15%, was associated with platelet transfusion with an N equal to 11, an adjusted odds ratio of 4.75, 95% confidence interval 1.03 to 21.92, and diuretics with an N equal to 74, odds ratio of 2.55, 95% confidence interval of 1.19 to 5.46. In multivariable analyses that adjusted for comorbidities, pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome risk factor, initial oxygen saturation by pulse oximetry to FiO2 ratio, and initial type of ventilation. Beta agonists were associated with lower adjusted odds of subsequent pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, with an odds ratio of 0.43 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.19 to 0.98. Platelets and diuretics were also associated with fewer PICU-free days and fewer ventilator-free days in the multivariable models, and TPN was associated with fewer PICU-free days. Corticosteroids, net fluid balance, and volume of enteral feeding were not associated with the primary or secondary outcomes. Conclusions: there is an independent association between platelet transfusion, diuretic administration, and unfavorable outcomes in children at risk for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome, although this may be related to treatment bias and unmeasured confounders. Nevertheless, prospective evaluation of the role of these management strategies on outcomes in children at risk for pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome is needed. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation by Lenz et al. Peri-intubation adverse events in the critically ill child after hematopoietic cell transplant. Objectives: mechanically ventilated children post-hematopoietic cell transplant have increased morbidity and mortality compared with other mechanically ventilated critically ill children. Tracheal intubation-associated adverse events and peri-intubation hypoxemia universally portend worse outcomes. We investigated whether adverse peri-intubation-associated events occur at increased frequency in patients with hematopoietic cell transplant compared with non-hematopoietic cell transplant oncologic or other PICU patients, and therefore might contribute to increased mortality. Design: retrospective cohort between 2014 and 2019. Setting: single-center academic non-cardiac PICU. Patients: critically ill children who underwent tracheal intubation. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Data from the local airway management quality improvement databases and virtual pediatric systems were merged. These data were supplemented with a retrospective chart review for hematopoietic cell transplant-related data, including hematopoietic cell transplant indication, transplant-related comorbidity status, and patient condition at the time of tracheal intubation procedure. The primary outcome was defined as the composite of hemodynamic tracheal intubation-associated adverse events, including hypo or hypertension, arrhythmia, and cardiac arrest, and/or peri-intubation hypoxemia events, defined as oxygen saturation less than 80%. 1,931 encounters underwent tracheal intubation, of which 92, or 4.8%, were post-hematopoietic cell transplant, while 319, or 16.5%, had history of malignancy without hematopoietic cell transplant, and 1,520, or 78.7%, had neither hematopoietic cell transplant nor malignancy. Children post-hematopoietic cell transplant were older, more often had respiratory failure as an indication for intubation, had use of catecholamine infusions peri-intubation, and use of non-invasive ventilation prior to intubation. hemodynamic tracheal intubation-associated adverse events, or peri-intubation hypoxemia, were not different across three groups: hematopoietic cell transplant in 16%, non-hematopoietic cell transplant with malignancy in 10%, other 15%. After adjusting for age, difficult airway feature, provider type, device, apneic oxygenation use, and indication for intubation, we did not identify an association between hematopoietic cell transplant status and the adverse tracheal intubation outcome, with an odds ratio of 1.32 for hematopoietic cell transplant status versus other, a 95% confidence interval of 0.72 to 2.41, and a p-value equal to 0.37. Conclusions. In this single-center study, we did not identify an association between hematopoietic cell transplant status and hemodynamic tracheal intubation-associated adverse events or peri-intubation hypoxemia during tracheal intubation. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation by Lozano Ray et al. Prevalence and incidence of pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome in a tertiary academic PICU in South Africa. Objectives. To determine the prevalence and incidence of pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome among infants and children admitted to the PICU. Design. A single-center descriptive point prevalence study with twice-weekly data collection over a six-month period from August 2020 to February 12, 2021. Patients. All infants and children admitted to the PICU on study days were included. Interventions. Data were captured electronically on a standardized case record form using a research electronic data capture electronic database. Measurements and main results. The pediatric acute lung injury consensus conference criteria were used to define pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome cases. Prevalence was calculated as the total number of pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome cases per 1,000 PICU bed days. The study included 354 patients with a median age of 10.1 months old and an interquartile range of 1.5 to 61.3 months old, with 204 males, or 57.6%, who occupied 879 bed days. Of these 879 bed days, 266 were occupied by pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome cases, or 30.3%, with a 95% confidence interval of 27.2 to 33.3%, with a calculated prevalence of 302.6 of 1,000 bed days, or 30.3%, an incidence of 29.7%, with a 95% confidence interval of 26.7 to 32.7%. Three cases from the cohort were defined using the oxygen saturation index calculation. In 494 cases receiving invasive ventilation, or 56.2%, pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome severity was classified as mild in 143, or 16.3%, moderate in 44, or 5%, and severe in 29, or 3.3%. A further 205 beds, or 23.3%, were occupied by patients classified as being at risk of pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome. In conclusion, the prevalence and incidence of pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome in a South African PICU appears substantially higher than findings described in international reports. Further investigation of risk factors and outcomes is warranted. Abstract 7 is a PCCM trial by Lambert et al. The Infant Kidney Dialysis and Ultrafiltration, or IKID study, a stepped wedge cluster randomized study in infants comparing peritoneal dialysis, continuous veno-venous hemofiltration, and Newcastle Infant Dialysis Ultrafiltration System, a novel hemodialysis device. Objectives. Renal replacement therapy options are limited for small babies because of lack of available technology. We investigated the precision of ultrafiltration, biochemical clearances, clinical efficacy, outcomes, and safety profile for a novel non-conformity European-marked hemodialysis device for babies under 8 kilograms, the Newcastle Infant Dialysis Ultrafiltration System, compared with the current options of peritoneal dialysis or continuous veno-venous hemofiltration. Design. Non-blinded cluster randomized cross-sectional stepped wedge design with 4 periods, 3 sequences, and 2 clusters per sequence. Setting. Clusters were 6 UK PICUs. Patients. Babies less than 8 kilograms requiring renal replacement therapy for fluid overload or biochemical disturbance. Interventions. In controls, renal replacement therapy was delivered by peritoneal dialysis or continuous veno-venous hemofiltration, and in interventions, the Newcastle Infant Dialysis Ultrafiltration System was used. The primary outcome was precision of ultrafiltration compared with prescription. Secondary outcomes included biochemical clearances. Measurements and main results. At closure, 97 participants were recruited from the 6 PICUs, including 62 controls and 35 interventions. The primary outcome, obtained from 62 controls and 21 intervention patients, showed that ultrafiltration with the Newcastle Infant Dialysis Ultrafiltration System was closer to that prescribed than with controls. The standard deviation of controls was 18.75 milliliters per hour, and the standard deviation with intervention was 2.95 milliliters per hour, with an adjusted ratio of 0.13, a 95% confidence interval of 0.03 to 0.71, and a p-value equal to 0.018. Creatinine clearance was smallest and least variable for peritoneal dialysis, with the mean equal to 0.08 and the standard deviation of 0.03 milliliters per minute per kilogram. Larger for the Newcastle Infant Dialysis Ultrafiltration System, with a mean of 0.46, a standard deviation of 0.3 milliliters per minute per kilogram, and largest for continuous veno-venous hemofiltration, with a mean of 1.2 and a standard deviation of 0.72 milliliters per minute per kilogram. Adverse events were reported in all groups. In this critically ill population with multiple organ failure, mortality was lowest for peritoneal dialysis and highest for continuous veno-venous hemofiltration, with the Newcastle Infant Dialysis Ultrafiltration System in between. Conclusions. The Newcastle Infant Dialysis Ultrafiltration System delivers accurate, controllable fluid removal and adequate clearances, indicating that it has important potential alongside other modalities for infant renal replacement therapy. Abstract 8 is an online clinical investigation by Percy et al. Mechanical power is associated with mortality in pediatric acute respiratory distress syndrome. Objectives. Mechanical power transferred from the ventilator to the lungs has been proposed as a summary variable that may impact mortality in children with acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. To date, no study has shown an association between higher mechanical power and mortality in children with ARDS. Design. Secondary analysis of a prospective observational study. Setting. Single-center tertiary academic PICU. Patients, 546 intubated children with ARDS enrolled between January 2013 and December 2019, receiving pressure-controlled ventilation. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Higher mechanical power was associated with increased mortality, with an adjusted hazard ratio of 1.34 per one standard deviation increase, a 95% confidence interval of 1.08 to 1.65, and a p-value equal to 0.007. When assessing the contribution of individual components of mechanical power, only positive end expiratory pressure, or PEEP, was associated with mortality, with a hazard ratio of 1.32 and a p-value equal to 0.007, whereas tidal volume, respiratory rate, and driving pressure, which was defined as the peak inspiratory pressure minus the PEEP, were not. Finally, we tested whether there remained an association when specific terms were removed from the mechanical power equation by calculating mechanical power from static strain, defined as removing the driving pressure, mechanical power from dynamic strain, defined as removing the PEEP, and mechanical energy, defined as removing the respiratory rate. Mechanical power from static strain had a hazard ratio of 1.44 and a p-value less than 0.001. Mechanical power from dynamic strain had a hazard ratio of 1.25 with a p-value equal to 0.042. And mechanical energy had a hazard ratio of 1.29 with a p-value equal to 0.009, and all were associated with mortality. Mechanical power was associated with ventilator-free days only when using mechanical power normalized to predicted body weight, but not when using measured weight. Conclusions. Higher mechanical power was associated with mortality in pediatric ARDS, and PEEP appears to be the component most consistently driving this association. As higher PEEP is used in sicker patients, the association between mechanical power and mortality may reflect a marker of illness severity rather than mechanical power itself being causal for mortality. However, our results support future trials testing different levels of PEEP in children with ARDS as a potential means to improve outcome. Abstract 9 is an online clinical investigation by Wilson et al. Performance of a provider-assigned functional outcome score in critically ill children. Objectives. Determine agreement between pediatric cerebral performance category scores integrated into clinical workflow and traditional investigator-assigned scores. Design, longitudinal study. Setting, a single-center quaternary care academic institution. Subjects, children admitted to the PICU between November 2019 and April 2020. Interventions, providers assigned pediatric cerebral performance category scores as part of daily workflow. Investigators assigned scores using retrospective chart review. Measurements and main results. Of 803 patients admitted to the PICU, 782 survived and were included. Admission and discharge scores were recorded in 95% and 90% of patients, respectively. Agreement between provider and investigator assigned scores was excellent, with a weighted kappa of 0.87 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.84 to 0.9 for admission and 0.8 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.76 to 0.84 for discharge. Conclusions. Provider assigned pediatric cerebral performance category scores documented as standard of care are largely concordant with retrospective investigator assigned scores. Measurement of cognitive functional status can be successfully integrated into daily provider workflow for use in the clinical, quality improvement, and research arenas. Abstract 10 is an online clinical investigation by Adarsha et al., an observational study on pattern of empirical acyclovir therapy in children with acute encephalitis from northern India. Objectives: to identify the prevalence of herpes simplex encephalitis, factors influencing the duration of empirical acyclovir and frequency of acute kidney injury in children with acute encephalitis syndrome. Design, prospective observational study. Setting, pediatric emergency department and PICU of a tertiary hospital in northern India. Patients, all consecutive eligible children between 1 month and 12 years old presenting with acute encephalitis syndrome defined as altered consciousness for greater than 24 hours, including lethargy, irritability, or a change in personality, and two or more of the following signs. 1. Fever, defined as temperature greater than or equal to 38 degrees Celsius during the current illness. 2. Seizures or focal neurological signs. 3. Cerebral spinal fluid or CSF pleocytosis. 4. Electroencephalogram and or 5. Neuroimaging suggesting encephalitis who received at least one dose of acyclovir. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Of the 101 children screened, 83 were enrolled. The median age was 3 years old with an interquartile range of 1 to 6 years old. 31 children, or 37.3%, were diagnosed with acute encephalitis syndrome, of which 4 were labeled as probable herpes simplex encephalitis, 3 based on MRI brain, 1 based on serology. Scrub typhus, dengue, Japanese encephalitis, and mumps were the other infective causes. The median duration of acyclovir therapy was 72 hours with an interquartile range of 24 to 264 hours. 21 children, or 25.3%, received acyclovir for less than 24 hours and 11, or 13.3%, for greater than or equal to 14 days. New onset acute kidney injury was seen in 18 children, or 21.7%, but was mostly transient. Death occurred in 8, or 9.6%, and discontinuation of care due to futility or other reasons occurred in 15, or 18%. Factors associated with duration of acyclovir greater than 7 days on univariable analysis were lower modified Glasgow Coma score at admission, requirement of invasive ventilation, invasive intracranial pressure monitoring, and CSF pleocytosis with 5 to 500 cells. On multivariable analysis, only CSF pleocytosis of 5 to 500 cells was associated with duration of acyclovir therapy greater than 7 days. Conclusions. Given the low prevalence of herpes simplex encephalitis and the risk of acute kidney injury, this study sensitizes the need to review our practice on initiation and stopping of empirical acyclovir in children with acute encephalitis. Abstract 11 is an online cardiac intensive care article by King et al. Sedation weaning initiative targeting methadone exposure, single center improvements in withdrawal symptoms and hospital length of stay for pediatric cardiac critical care. Objectives. Sedation and pain medications are necessary in the management of postoperative pediatric cardiac patients. Prolonged exposure to these medications can lead to negative side effects, including withdrawal. We hypothesized that standardized weaning guidelines would decrease exposure to sedation medications and decrease withdrawal symptoms. The primary aim was to decrease average days of methadone exposure to within goal for moderate and high-risk patients within 6 months. Design. quality improvement methods were used to standardize sedation medication weaning in a pediatric cardiac ICU. Setting: this study took place at Duke Children's Hospital Pediatric Cardiac ICU in Durham, North Carolina, from January 1, 2020 to December 31, 2021. Patients: children less than 12 months old admitted to the pediatric cardiac ICU who underwent cardiac surgery. Interventions: sedation weaning guidelines were implemented over the course of 12 months. Data were tracked every 6 months and compared with the 12 months pre-intervention. Patients were stratified into low, moderate, and high-risk withdrawal categories based on duration of opioid infusion exposure. Measurements and main results. Total sample size was 94 patients in the moderate and high-risk categories. Process measures included documentation of withdrawal assessment tool scores and appropriate methadone prescription in patients, which increased to 100% post-intervention. For outcome measures, we observed decreased dexmedetomidine infusion duration, decreased methadone wean duration, decreased frequency of elevated withdrawal assessment tool scores, and decreased hospital length of stay post-intervention. For the primary aim, methadone wean duration consistently decreased after each study period. Our intervention did not adversely impact balancing measures. Conclusions: a quality improvement initiative to standardize sedation weaning in a pediatric cardiac ICU was successfully implemented and was correlated with decreased duration of sedation medications, decreased withdrawal scores, and decreased length of stay. Abstract 12 is an online cardiac intensive care article by LaCroix et al. Objectives: phlebotomy can account for significant blood loss in post-surgical pediatric cardiac patients. We investigated the effectiveness of a phlebotomy volume display in the electronic medical record, or EMR, to decrease laboratory sampling and blood transfusions. Cost analysis was performed. Design: this is a prospective interrupted time series quality improvement study. Cross-sectional surveys were administered to medical personnel pre- and post-intervention. Setting: the study was conducted in a 19-bed cardiac ICU at a children's hospital. Patients: 109 post-surgical pediatric cardiac patients weighing 10 kilograms or less with an ICU stay of 30 days or less were included. Interventions: we implemented a phlebotomy volume display in the intake and output section of the EMR, along with a calculated maximal phlebotomy volume display based on 3% of patient total blood volume as a reference. Measurements and main results: providers poorly estimated phlebotomy volume regardless of role, practice setting, or years in practice. Only 12% of providers reported the availability of laboratory sampling volume. After implementation of the phlebotomy display, there was a reduction in mean laboratories drawn per patient day from 9.5 to 2.5, with a p-value equal to 0.005, and single electrolytes draw per patient over the CICU stay from 6.1 to 1.6, with a p-value equal to 0.016. After implementation of the reference display, mean phlebotomy volume per patient over the CICU stay decreased from 30.9 to 14.4 milliliters, with a p-value equal to 0.038. Blood transfusion volume did not decrease. CICU length of stay, intubation time, number of reintubations, and infection rates did not increase. Nearly all CICU personnel supported the use of the display. The financial cost of laboratory studies per patient has a downward trend and decreased for hemoglobin studies and electrolytes per patient after the intervention. Conclusions: providers may not readily have access to phlebotomy volume requirements for laboratories, and most estimate phlebotomy volumes inaccurately. A well-designed phlebotomy display in the EMR can reduce laboratory sampling and associated costs in the pediatric cardiac ICU without an increase in adverse patient outcomes. Abstract 13 is an online review article by Sethasathyan et al. Aortic peak flow velocity as a predictor of fluid responsiveness in mechanically ventilated children, a systematic review and meta-analysis. Objectives: this meta-analysis aimed to determine the accuracy of the respiratory variations in aortic peak flow velocity in predicting fluid responsiveness and the moderators of that accuracy. Data sources: we performed searches for studies that used aortic peak flow velocity as a predictor of fluid responsiveness in mechanically ventilated children in PubMed, Embase, Scopus, and CIN-AHL from inception to June 20, 2022. Study selection and data extraction: 15 studies, with an N equal to 452, were included in this meta-analysis. The diagnostic test data of the included studies were synthesized as pooled sensitivity, specificity, and diagnostic odds ratio, and the area under the curve of the summary receiver operating characteristic of aortic peak flow velocity. Data synthesis. The aortic peak flow velocity cutoff values applied in these studies had a median of 12.3% with an interquartile range of 11.5 to 13.25%. The pooled sensitivity of aortic peak flow velocity was 0.8 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.71 to 0.87, and the pooled specificity of aortic peak flow velocity was 0.82 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.75 to 0.87. The diagnostic odds ratio of aortic peak flow velocity was 23.41 with a 95% confidence interval of 11.61 to 47.2. The area under the curve of aortic peak flow velocity was 0.87. Subgroup analyses revealed that the accuracy of aortic peak flow velocity was not moderated by ventilator settings, measures of aortic peak flow velocity, gold standard index, the cutoff gold standard value of responders, type and volume of fluid, duration of fluid challenge, use of vasoactive drugs, general anesthesia, and cardiopulmonary bypass. Conclusions. By using the cutoff of approximately 12.3%, the aortic peak flow velocity appears to have good accuracy in predicting fluid responsiveness in mechanically ventilated children. The moderators of aortic peak flow velocity predictability are not found. This month's PCCM narrative is entitled Thinking of the Moms by Dr. Melissa Yildirim. My body is somehow out of bed and moving before my mind is fully awake, pulling toward the siren song of my baby crying across the hallway. I scoop her up from her crib, and she insistently nuzzles into my chest, demanding love and milk. I smile because I'm nuzzling her too. I bury my face in her downy soft hair and breathe in her intoxicating baby smell. Together, we sink into the rocking chair, and I pull a blanket down to tuck us in. Warm and nursing in my arms, she calms. I kiss her head, settle in, and I let my thoughts drift. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm thinking of all the families in my PICU, and especially of the moms. I'm thinking of the moms who are aching to hold their babies. Those moms who fall asleep with their arms stretched through the bars of the crib or dozed off at the foot of the bed. They smooth hair. They rearrange stuffed animals. They hold hands through IVs and x-rays and yet another doctor coming in to listen. I'm thinking of the mom who told me, as her six-week-old took a turn for the worse, that she had never held him. Please, I need to hold him just once. I'm thinking of the mom who had fought her son's disease every moment of his 17 years. At the end, she climbed into his bed and laid her head on his chest. She felt his final heartbeat, then hit the call bell to let us know. Does she remember the prenatal visit when she heard it beat for the first time, too? I am thinking of the moms who can't sleep, the ones who are soothing, shushing, patting, defending, watching, pacing all night long. Their eyes flicker between the flashing monitor and the busy staff. They spring up from sleeping in armchairs, wide awake, fight or flight, when someone enters the room. I'm thinking of the mom who joked she didn't even need to sleep anymore after so many nights on alert in the PICU. But then I'm remembering her jotting down meticulous notes on morning rounds the following week. I can't seem to remember anything anyone says. I remember the mom who woke to a true nightmare, lights flashing on as I shouted for help while starting compressions. She didn't scream. She ducked into the hallway to make space for the team, an experienced PICU mom. I wonder how she could ever sleep again after that night. I'm thinking of the moms who are pumping, the moms who are sitting in the corner, half undressed, as a team of strangers breezes into the room to round. I am thinking of the milk math, of just needing a few more ounces, of crying over spills. I am thinking of the love of moms, who first build their babies from blood and sweat, and then continue to give so generously from their own bodies after birth. There is pride, there is hope in the cache of full snappies and baggies of milk. There is fierce sisterhood. I lead rounds one day, unknowingly covered in breast milk, and a PICU mom helps me learn to laugh it off. Sometimes there is heartbreak. Do you know how I can donate my milk? Another baby should have it if he can't. I remember a mom crying as she told me she had stopped pumping, and I cried too, because I knew that she had realized her baby was going to die. I am split open by motherhood. My heart lives outside of my body now, exposed and tender. Nestled safe in my arms, my daughter is deeply asleep. She is milk drunk and so heavy, but I can't put her down. Not yet. I hug her closer, selfish, grateful. I hug her and think of all the PICU moms longing for their babies tonight. This concludes the abstracts for the July 2023 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.